Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you by the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Stephen Leckart, correspondent for Wired Magazine. It's my pleasure to introduce Jaron Lanier, co-founder of VPL Research and author of Who Owns the Future? When Jaron was 13, he convinced New Mexico State University to allow him to enroll in computer programming and mathematical notation graduate level courses. He started his career at Atari and in 1985 co-founded VPL Research, focusing on virtual reality technologies. Jaron is the best-selling author of You Are Not a Gadget and a columnist for Discover Magazine. He composes music for stage and film productions, and his paintings and drawings have been exhibited in galleries and museums throughout the U.S. and Europe. He is scholar at large for Microsoft Research, innovator in resident at USC Annenberg, and a fellow at the World Economic Forum and the MacArthur Foundation Roundtables. For his numerous professional contributions, Jaron has received the Carnegie Mellon University's Watson Award and the IEEE Virtual Reality Career Award. He was also recognized as one of Global Business Network's 100 Most Remarkable People, one of the top 10 public intellectuals in the world by readers of Prospect and Foreign Policy magazines, and named one of Time's 100 Most Influential People in 2010. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jaron Lanier.
Thanks so much for having me here. I'm going to talk a little bit about how we can confuse ourselves and our civilization with information systems. I will mention just as an example that in that introduction, almost all the facts were wrong, I'm sorry to say, but that's okay. Just for anyone listening, you can, this might be one case where the Wikipedia is slightly more reliable. or maybe, was this from the Wikipedia? I don't know. Anyway, what I'd like to talk to you about is the relationship between information technology and economics. I have been involved in information technology for many, many years. I worked on virtual reality. I was the chief scientist of the Engineering Office of Internet 2 in the 90s and was fascinated with how to build out the Internet so it could become large and scale, as we like to say in the Valley. And for all that, for all those years, I was filled with expectation that when digital networking hit the world, what would result would be this huge wave of improvement, of well-being, of the spreading of wealth, of the creation of opportunity. I was just tangibly filled with anticipation for when that would happen. When it started to happen, when people started to get online, when the web took off, and then when there started to be huge new companies and institutions using the web in various ways, I was waiting, I was looking for this huge improvement, and I never saw it. Instead, what I saw, especially since the turn of the century or the turn of the millennium, instead what I saw was the spread of austerity and recession across the developed world. I saw a reduction in the powers of the middle class in the developed world. I saw a loss of social mobility and an intense concentration of wealth and power. Now, I'm mentioning the developed world very carefully because I think the developing world is a different story. And if we have time, I'd like to talk about it. But for the purpose of this talk, I'm concentrating on the developed world, which is where we hope the developing world is headed. So thus our optimistic labeling of it. So I think we have to think about the developed world. So when I looked around at these intense concentrations of wealth and power that seemed to have arisen, every single one of them was in proximity with some giant computer that was networked. This is true especially in finance, where we saw these giant financial schemes to bundle derivatives and exotic hedge funds, or where we see high-frequency trading and all sorts of other exotic schemes. It was true in the world of consumer communications with companies like Google and Facebook and all the rest. It was true in governments and in elections. The elections that were winning in the developed world were increasingly the ones that were good at using big computers. And I started to realize that there had been a little flaw in our thinking. So the original thought, which was the sweetest and most innocent and most lovely thought, and I still think about it and get a little warm feeling inside because it sustained me and my friends for so many years, that little thought was that with digital networks, people could share information and knowledge and perspective, and there could be this huge virtuous cycle of betterment. And it made perfect sense. The little flaw was that if you have a bunch of people sharing information openly, people might be created equal, but computers are not created equal. Some computers are vastly bigger and more powerful than other computers. Some computers run faster, are better connected. A lot of them have better mathematicians working for them as well. Whoever has the best computer, just as a matter of course, almost automatically, no matter how good their intentions are, will be able to outcompute everybody else. It's kind of a superpower, and it creates a gigantic inequity. Let me give you an example of how this works. The most familiar example, really, in the American context is health insurance. Before big computers and networking arrived, of course, insurance companies wanted to only insure people who didn't need to be insured. What else would they want, right? That's natural enough. However, it was hard to gather all the information. It was hard to calculate with it accurately. And so actuaries, the people who do that sort of thing, were kind of operating blind. They had to be pretty clever to do anything at all. With the advent of computer networks and the ability to gather data from everywhere and giant computers that can process it, everything changes and you can start to do a pretty good job. So suddenly you become tempted to try to create the perfect insurance business where, you know, where you only insure the people who are going to need your insurance the least. Now, what this reminds me of is actually a little imaginary creature called Maxwell's Demon, who some of you might have met in school. Maxwell's Demon is a thought experiment used to teach thermodynamics. Don't run scared. It's not that hard if you're not technical. This demon is really cool. He operates a little tiny door, and what he does is he lets only the hot molecules go. He only opens the door if a hot molecule wants to head from left to right, let's say, or he'll open it if a cold molecule wants to go in the other direction. And just by opening and closing this door very carefully over time, he can separate the hot and the cold molecules. And then eventually he can open another door to run a turbine and generate power and then repeat and create a perpetual motion machine. Right? Doesn't that sound great? And then the reason it doesn't work is the very act of discrimination, the very act of doing anything with information is itself work. And it requires power, it generates waste heat, and it requires enough of it that you can never get ahead. And every single possible perpetual motion machine will turn out to be like Maxwell's Demon. But there's no free lunch. But what you're doing when you have a big computer and you're active in a society is you naturally want to become Maxwell's Demon. You want to let those hot patients go one way and those cold patients go the other way to make the perfect investment. You're trying to create a free lunch. And just like in building machines, you can't do it. You can't make a perfect investment. You try to radiate all the risk into somebody else, but the society is not infinitely large. It can't absorb all that risk. So what happens every time somebody tries to create the perfect scheme using giant computers is they do radiate all the risk on everybody else, then we all have to pay for it. This is exactly what happened with big finance since the big computers became available. It actually happened with finance earlier than it did with the web and all that because, I hate to bring these old incidents up, but Enron and long-term capital were early experiments in trying to do this. And every experiment that tries to do this will meet exactly the same fate and for the same reason. There isn't an infinitely large society to absorb all the cost and risk that are radiated by these attempts to create perfect schemes. So we've seen it happen in insurance. We've seen it happen in finance of all sorts. The problem is that as this century progresses, more and more of the economy will be an information economy. That's what happens when technology gets better. We've already seen vehicles drive themselves more safely than people can drive them. This is a great thing from my point of view. my mom, having survived a concentration camp, was killed in a car accident. We slaughter each other by the tens of thousands because we're terrible at driving vehicles. I saw that firsthand today driving here. We're terrible at it. So it is something that simply must be automated. It's a matter of just decency to do it. Now, that's only one example. And in that case, we have huge legions of people who will lose their jobs eventually. The Teamsters, the truck drivers, the cabbies, delivery guys and gals. But the thing is, every monetized, every economic aspect of what we do can eventually turn into something that's information mediated. I like that term instead of saying that it's automated, because I think saying something's automatic is a little misleading, as I'll explain in a second. We've already seen robots that are more reliable as pharmacists than humans, legal researchers, all kinds of things. I've worked on automated robotic surgery. There's no profession except for owning a giant computer that can't eventually succumb to becoming information mediated. Now, the thing about the growing information economy is it actually doesn't make people obsolete. There's just an illusion that it does. Now, let me explain why I say that's an illusion. One of the magic, seemingly magic things you can do these days online is you can upload some text in one language and have it translated to another language, English to Spanish, let's say. Google and Microsoft both offer that service, and it works well enough to use, maybe not perfectly. And so the popular way of thinking about that is that there's some magic brain online that just does this artificial brain. That's the language we use. We call it artificial intelligence. But it's not actually what's happening. It was something people wanted. I remember when I was a kid, I heard from my mentor at the time, Marvin Minsky, about these early hopes from the late 50s where he and his colleagues would assign a graduate student the summer job of just trying to figure out the magic formula to translate between languages, as if a smart enough mathematician could just unlock it in this pristine little perfect, you know, formula, like the way Einstein unlocked gravity and time, you know. But that turns out not to work. The thing that does work is entirely different. What we do is we gather real examples of real translations by real people, real humans, and we gather them in massive numbers, and then we pattern match the text that you want to translate against passages that have already been translated, and we make a mashup of what had been previous effective translations, and what you're delivered is that mashup of real work by real people. Okay? So the point is that AI in the classic sense doesn't work, but big data does work, but big data is just people in disguise. So the thing is that this wave of automation that could start to work in this century, which I view as being very desirable, does not make people obsolete. The only question is whether we acknowledge the value that people are still putting into the economy or not. If we don't, we'll concentrate fantastic amounts of wealth and power around the people who own the biggest computers. If we do, I think we might very well achieve something profoundly important, which is we might be able to create a persistent middle class in a healthier way than we have in the past. Now, this becomes a big topic that, you know, it requires a book to describe this whole topic, but in the briefest terms, the fact that when I say middle class, this can mean many things. To many of my friends, it means some sort of stultifying bourgeois mentality that we should all run screaming from. I don't think that's what I'm talking about. All I'm talking about is what the American founders talked about in Resisting an Aristocracy. The idea is simply that there has to be a plentitude of people who can collectively outspend any particular elite. The middle has to be able to outspend the tip in the distribution of outcomes in a society, no matter what kind of society you like. If you're a libertarian and you want to have an active market economy, there have to be customers, or else you end up with some kind of petrostate that's a fake economy. If you're interested in society and you're sort of left-leaning, there has to be the bulk of people have to be able to outspend the tip, any elite, or you can't have a stable and uncorrupted democracy. So no matter what kind of society you want, you have to have a strong middle. The only way we've had a strong middle in the past is through ad hoc mechanisms that protect people from the turbulence of both markets and social processes like democracy, both of which often are dysfunctional. We have a tendency to prefer one of the, or the other. A lot of people like markets and think democracy is dysfunctional, and then there are people who think democracy is dysfunctional. And people like one or the other. The truth is they're both often dysfunctional, and they have to balance each other. But at any rate, the only way we've been able to have a middle bulk that can outspend the elite tip is with special mechanisms like unions, which were tremendously hard to get going, tenure for scholars, cosmetology licenses, taxing medallions, and on and on, all these special little mechanisms. What's interesting is if you look at how people share information on a network that's really well connected, that's densely connected, it doesn't necessarily form into an elite little tip of superstars. You see a lot of people interested in what a lot of other people do on social networks like Facebook. And the distribution, if it were monetized, would start to create something that looks like a middle class, which I think is remarkable. And it's one of the reasons I'm optimistic that we still might get the benefits that we always anticipated from digital technology. The problem, however, is that the way we've structured digital networks, the power kind of flows to the biggest computer. And the reason for that is that the information being free creates this unnatural system where there's no cost to spy on people. And if there's no cost to spy, spying becomes unbounded, and then the use of having the bigger computer to advantage becomes unbounded and unchecked. So you start to see outcomes in a system that's run this way that have a winner-take-all quality. You only have a few winners who can get anywhere on something like YouTube or Kickstarter or any of the others where there's a central hub. You start to have only a few winners in financial schemes, in any scheme that's mediated by giant computers. And if there are only a few winners, as I'm saying, you end up with a new kind of aristocracy. So how did we end up with the system? It's strange because the birth of digital networking as an idea, which goes back to 1960 with Ted Nelson's work, actually anticipated all these problems and intended to avoid these problems very explicitly. The first idea for networking, which was called hypermedia or hypertext, which is still reflected in the HT and HTML on the web, that idea was that there'd be universal micropayments. So if your information was used by somebody in some way, there could be a little payment back to you. There were a variety of other architectural qualities to it. I won't go into the whole of what there was and what's been lost, but for a variety of reasons, we undid the original plan, which I think might have given us a much better result. Instead, we opted for what in retrospect seems like a little bit of a childish or an overly simplistic idea that information should be free, files should be freely copied, everything should be open, and that would be great if everyone was issued an identical computer and identically talented mathematicians to run it and all that. But, of course, that's not our world. So, therefore, this naive kind of openness has led instead to incredible concentrations of wealth and power like we've never seen. One of the examples in the book is about what's happened with imaging. In the age of film, the company Kodak employed almost 150,000 people with good middle-class jobs just to deal with getting film out to people. This is not even dealing with the people who made the cameras or the photo albums or all the developers out there. There was a huge industry. Now, when that industry was made efficient through digital technology, like our wonderful little cameras in our phones now, and of course being able to share photos over the net, that efficiency didn't turn into general spreading of wealth. It turned instead into an intense concentration of wealth. So Instagram sold for $1 billion to Facebook with only 13 employees. Now, I want to emphasize, I'm a Silicon Valley guy. I like success, and I have nothing against those 13 people. I've been successful. I've made a number of startups. I sold a startup to Google, and there's another one that's part of Adobe and so forth, another one that's part of Oracle now. I have no problem with success. It's just that I want to create success by growing the economy instead of shrinking it. And I think that you can have successes like the individuals found at Instagram in a way that doesn't shrink the economy. But what we're doing is we do shrink markets in order to concentrate our wealth. There are some venture capital firms in the Valley now that explicitly say we invest in schemes that shrink markets. You know, that's a respectable way of thinking. And, of course, it's a very short-term way of thinking. What we're doing to ourselves is exactly what the insurance industry and the financial schemes have done to themselves, which is we're radiating risk and cost out to a society that isn't big enough to absorb them. Another way to put this is that we've decided the only business plan that's viable in the information space, because we believe information should be free, is to use behavioral models of people or models of the world to manipulate the world. Now, I'm putting it pretty starkly, but that's a much better description of what companies like Google and Facebook sell than the term advertising. Because manipulating what options in front of you is really not like advertising. It's not a communication act. It's a subtle manipulation of what next steps are put in front of you. And it's a shame, because what it means is that companies with entirely different competencies and cultures, like Facebook and Google, which should be as different as could be, instead have to compete for approximately the same customer base. And it's a customer base that'll be gradually shrunk by those very companies, because as more and more aspects of the economy become information mediated, then their information will be gathered for free in order to place links and all that, but there'll be fewer and fewer people to buy links, because those businesses that used to buy links will be demonetized in the way recorded music has been and the way so many other things are about to be. In the book, I present a few scenarios, for instance, how the pharmaceutical industry might be demonetized in the way the music industry was. But there's absolutely no aspect of the economy that's immune to this process, as I said. So we simply must learn to turn this around. We need to learn to turn it around both to have a viable distribution of outcomes in a society in order to have either markets or democracy, as I said. But we also need it for another reason that might be even more important, which is to be able to benefit from big data in a way that's not clouded by corruption. Now, let me explain what I mean by this. Big data is the sense organ by which we can tell what's going on in this world in which people have started to form their own fate. If that's too abstract, think about global climate change. Global climate change became visible to us early because of big data. But the interesting thing about it is we weren't able to receive the news about climate change because it upset people, and in fact, it still is very hard for people to accept reality as presented by big data. Similarly, it has to be said, the economics behind austerity were based on a data calculation that turned out to be an error. But because people like that one, or at least a lot of people do, that one is sort of still respected, even though it's been thoroughly discredited. So the question, how do we learn how to use big data as a proper sense organ, as something that we can trust? Well, we have to get used to the idea that data isn't nonsense. And right now, because the biggest and fastest fortunes in history can be accumulated by using data for manipulation without regard to sort of a base kind of truth, our society is based on kind of treating data as malleable, as not reflecting reality. What do I mean by that? People routinely meet their dates and their mates online right now through services that are supposed to have algorithms that optimize human relationships. But to my knowledge, every single time a psychologist or social scientist has studied these algorithms, they've turned out to not actually function. So we're letting algorithms guide some of the most intimate aspects of our lives, even though there's absolutely no indication that they're valid, that they work. We let algorithms choose our music to listen to, which is perhaps less consequential. But the point is we're used to this idea. And the reason why this is promoted again and again is that it's when people allow their lives to be manipulated by some big computer, the people who run the big computer get wealthier and more powerful. So there's this motivational cycle. And the key idea here is that if we run our civilization that way, we will never learn to be able to understand big data in a way that's uncorrupted by the power associated with the big computers. The way to temper this process is by making information cost money. This very idea is anathema to many of my friends from the sort of digital movement, if we can call it that, because we've believed that information should be free for so long. But let me give you a couple of examples of how making information cost money could be helpful. One example is that it can temper governments. I don't think a government should ever be allowed to do anything for free. The budget that a government has is the people's primary way of restraining it. That's why Congress is such an important institution. So if we say that information is free, then there's, because the gadgets cost less and less, like the cameras and the networking gear and all, there's basically in the long term no restraint at all on government surveillance. If information costs something, then you get a penny when the government recognizes you in a street camera. And this is a very interesting dynamic. In my view, what should happen is you should be able to set your own price. And then market forces will sort of sort out a way for the government to be able to afford to recognize enough people to gather data to make streets safer or to solve crimes, but people will be able to find their own balance of privacy. Now that sounds like a very exotic idea and it sounds complicated. It might sound unwieldy, but if it sounds that way, it's only because you don't know what we're doing now. It's actually vastly more elegant and compact than what goes on right now, which is this huge hodgepodge of just gargantuan inefficiencies. I mean, right now, Just to copy movies without paying for them, we're like multiplying the carbon footprint of the internet many, many, many times over. And just the inefficiency of the way we're doing things is a sin. And this system would be more efficient because we'd be more focused on what's actually what actually needs to be done. So just because it sounds exotic and inefficient, you have to think in relative terms. It probably would end up being vastly more efficient and focused on what we do. So this idea of bringing a budget into information could bring a sense of balance. It suggests a world that's very different than the world we're used to. Right now, we're used to a world where every once in a while you earn money, but you're spending all the time in dribs and drabs. You spend money for a coffee, but you only get a salary twice a month or something like that. In this world, you'd constantly be earning in little dribs and drabs. You'd be earning little tiny ways, and they'd add up over time. And they'd create a cushion for people so that people could grow up and have kids and afford to get sick once in a while and all that kind of stuff. You could be human, I think, in this world. You might wonder, well, will people offer enough value? One of the points of skepticism that I run into a lot is this feeling that most people wouldn't offer much value in this world. One of the reasons I think they will is just looking at what people find interesting online. People find a great diversity of things interesting. They don't concentrate entirely on just a few sources of information when they're in an open, thickly connected network, like within Facebook, for instance. So I find reason for optimism there. I also suggest, just as an exercise, look at all the things you do in life where you get a so-called discount for giving away your information to somebody you're interacting with, like your club card at a grocery store or your mileage plan. And if you look at the differential between what you save, quote unquote, I mean, this notion that that's a saving is a misnomer, but you can start to estimate how much your information is worth now in these little ways. And I think it adds up to a fair amount already. But the more automation there is as the century proceeds, the more things like that will be. And, the idea of going into a market economy from something that had been informal is always a leap of faith. It happened in the American West, where land was free, even though it was only accessed through monopolists like railroad barons, but it was free and then gradually turned into a real estate system. And when things turn into an economy, it's there's this leap of faith that maybe there will just be a few winners and then everybody else will lose. But actually what you want is economic growth where more people do better than they would have otherwise. And I believe that can happen with information. I just want to close with one comment. I'm occasionally accused of being a pessimist or being dark, and I feel just the opposite. I feel filled with optimism. I'm excited about solving these problems. I feel a total continuity between what I'm saying now and what I've done for years. We worked really hard to build the internet. We made some assumptions. We had some hypotheses. They've been proven wrong. This is called empiricism. As engineers, what we do is we make things better. It's completely wrong to confuse optimism and complacency. Complacency is the opposite of optimism. Demanding that the world become better is precisely the definition of optimism, and that's what I'm doing.
Well, that was terrific. Thank you, Jaron, for sharing your insights with us. We have a number of questions from the audience, but I'd like to begin. I'm glad that you made that remark about optimism and sort of the misnomer about you being a pessimist. 10 years ago that you were, I think maybe it was a more overt optimist, or maybe it seemed like you were more of a believer, so to speak. What sort of shifted or changed in you and set you down this path of thinking?
Well, I helped make up the music should be free rhetoric. When was that? That was like 25 years ago or something. The decades kind of blur together after a while. In your intro to me, you had the 80s and the 90s mixed up and a few things like that, but that's okay.
They provided the text. I should just...
Fine. No, I know.
I don't do my own fact checking.
No, I know. No, I mean, that's the interesting thing about this is that information isn't contextualized these days. So you don't know where it came from. And what changed for me was just looking at the real world. Like, I was absolutely convinced that the music labels were evil incarnate, and that if we freed musicians from the labels, all musicians would do better. And I had direct experience because I was a musician signed to a label. It was called PolyGram, and it was like this big thing at one time in the 90s. And what I started to see was a very different phenomenon than what I expected. Right now, we live with this weird illusion that there are these huge legions of young musicians who are finding their way and doing great with YouTube videos and Kickstarter campaigns or whatever. And I've actually gone out every year to count the people, to actually find them and figure out how many people are actually doing well. And they're just tiny, tiny numbers. It's actually this huge lie. There are people who pretend to be doing well, but they actually have money independently or whatever. There are people who pretend to be doing well as an incantation, which I respect. That's how the entertainment business has always worked. But, in terms of people who are actually doing well, we're talking about just handfuls, tiny, tiny numbers. And that... I'm an empiricist, I'm an engineer. I can't just say, I believe this program works and therefore it has not crashed. You are simply perceiving it to have crashed. You can't do that. You have to actually say, no, the thing crashed, fix the damn bug. And so it's just empiricism. It's just trying to be honest.
And so, was there a particular moment in my music was it for you that was just it? You saw that it was just a sham and suddenly you went down this path of...
I saw people really suffer. I think there was one moment when I had gone through every single week participating and trying to come up with an ad hoc fundraiser for somebody who was middle-aged and didn't have health insurance, who'd once been a celebrated musician, and I realized, oh my God, our utopia is not working. And that probably happened about 10 years ago. Yeah, I think you're about right. I mean, I started to turn on this stuff a little earlier than that. But I think as of around the turn of the century, I was still writing manifestos that sound a lot like what you'd find today on all the, information wants to be free, normal. It's become an orthodoxy. It's become the mainstream.
Did that surprise you, though?
It's funny. When you're young and, you're filled with ambition and you don't think you're finite and you do something, yeah, you sort of believe you'll take over the world, but somehow you don't really believe it. And to me, the notion that I run into young people who are mouthing at me stuff I made up when I was their age as if I'm an old guy who doesn't get it, and it just It's twisted. You know, it makes me feel like the world is some Mobius strip or something. You know, it's like surreal.
It
pageant.
Is. It actually
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned too that, you know, for your last book that your daughter was sort of the muse. I mean, becoming a father and sort of having that sort of tangible object in your house that says there is a generation beyond you, how did that inform your thinking?
Yeah, I'm sure it did. That was a really big deal. I mean, there is this sense, there's this thing about technology and youth. There's this quality of, when you're young, you can believe you're an abstract entity that won't age, that won't need health insurance, you know, you can promote your music career by crashing on couches and who needs money. And it's a beautiful way to think. And it's not something that's the province or the left of the left or the right. I mean, when people who dislike government and dislike government health insurance talk about how the free market would be better, they speak as if everybody were this abstract entity who could decide when to get sick and all that. But people on the left do exactly the same thing. We all want to believe that we're like our computers in a way, you know, that we're these pristine, perfect things. The mythology around computerdom has always had that quality where we're building this thing that's more perfect than us, but of course we're not. It's all theater. It's only us, and we're going to continue to be fragile and imperfect.
And in a sense, with this book, I mean, is it a continuation of those ideas and your thinking about your daughter and sort of what we're leaving for the generation beyond us?
Yeah, of course. I mean, in my community of alpha geeks or whatever we are, a lot of my friends often talk about trying to become immortal if we can just solve a few more technical puzzles. And
just a few.
Well, I don't know, but I mean, there is this continued fantasy that we can escape the bounds of being of particularity, of being of a particular time and place, and having particular vulnerabilities, and instead become like these perfect abstract Platonic computation nodes or something. And I mean, even our computers aren't like that. You know, code is always buggy. It's not the way reality is. Reality is chaotic and it's filled with transformation, and it's a form of death denial. I mean, it's similar to all human cultures. But I do think when you have kids, it helps you see outside of that world of illusion just for a moment, just a little tiny bit. I don't know if we ever fully see outside of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that in a sense she keeps you optimistic?
So
you're not just a critic?
You know, one of the great things about having kids is how fearless they are towards you. Because, I mean, everybody, anybody who achieves any stature and is used to, you know, maybe isn't reminded often enough of their own frailties or how they can be too full of themselves, their kids will take care of that for them. And I love that. I mean, that's one of the best things about being a parent.
So, you know, with this book, you know, part of what I find interesting about the ideas, and I personally agree with a lot of them, that, you know, we should be aware of what's being done with our data and people are making money off of our data. But what about the argument that, you know, for instance, health information, that the more health information we gather together, that there are researchers who can comb through it and maybe find cures for ails, and you do progressively more interesting research. What about that argument?
Right. And so I think the answer to that is to fund health research. You know, and I don't mean to sound too glib about that, but in a world where information isn't absolutely free, it doesn't mean it's inaccessible. In fact, I think it becomes more accessible. You know, what happens right now is that in the freeness of information is a sham, because the most consequential information is precisely the information you'll never see. You'll never see the algorithms that model your own behavior that are buried in the vaults of 1,000 computers that are spying on you all the time. And that's the actual, you know, those correlative models of you are the really consequential data about your life. And that includes your health, because the health insurance companies are making those models of you. And, you know, so what happens when you make information free is you actually create this other strata of information that's super buried and super intensely secret. And so, you know, making it paid doesn't mean it's not affordable. This is something that really bugs me. Like, we shouldn't imagine that the utopia means a perpetual place for poverty. We should imagine that utopia is a place in which poverty is overcome and needed things are affordable. And I think that should count for information for health research.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think about it like checking a donor box on the driver's license. If I can do greater good for somebody else, that maybe I'm giving back to folks. I mean,
and it's a beautiful sentiment. And so it makes me sometimes feel like Dr. Evil if I'm talking about monetizing information, because of course you want to share. But the thing about it is, the overall system is actually helped more by moderating the concentrations of power that come from people being able to take advantage of your sharing more than others because they have the bigger computer. You know, it's a beautiful sentiment, but it doesn't actually lead to the better outcome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you mentioned Instagram and Kodak, and I think that that's actually a really interesting fact that people are pulling out in reviews and talking about, and it's really interesting. But the other side to this is that, you know, Instagram is one company and it's $1 billion and it's 13 employees, but there's a certain kind of like ecosystem that exists for those kinds of apps. There's companies, for instance, that have sprung up around printing Instagram photographs or doing them on woodcut blocks and sending them to you and mailing them, physical objects that exist. And I'm not saying it's a massive economy there, but it's some money and it's some job creation. How do you sort of, I guess, reconcile that with your thoughts?
Well, part of this has to do with trying to distinguish between formal economic benefits and informal economic benefits. So a lot of people say, well, this free information world, like the Facebooks and the Instagrams and all that, create a lot of informal benefits because somebody doing woodblock printing or something, and I think that's really cool stuff, by the way, can get access to people more easily. The problem with informal economic benefits is that that's what the developing world is trying to get out of. Informal benefits can help you find customers. They can quote unquote save you money, but you can't really create economic growth out of them. You can't create a stable life cycle out of them. You can't plan for old age out of informal benefits. You know, you have to sing for your supper for every meal in a world of informal benefits. So it's an inferior kind of wealth creation. It's not even wealth creation. It's income creation once in a while. But then the other thing is, if you look at the distribution of the people who benefit from this type of opportunity that's created by these giant computers, I call them siren servers in the book, Who Owns the Future, there's a winner-take-all distribution. There's a little peak, and then there's a long tail. So of the ecosystem companies that can benefit from Instagram, there'll be just a few winners, then a whole bunch of wannabes. And you see that again and again and again. When you have the central hub, you have this winner-take-all distribution instead of a nice bell curve that can create a stable society.
In the book, you isolate, I think, about 10 siren servers. Can you take us through those 10? I mean, I'm sure I could guess them. I'm sure everyone here could guess them, but take us through them.
Yeah, well, some of the biggies are the insurance companies. But the biggest ones and the most consequential ones right now are the ones in finance. And so high-frequency trading schemes are really big. And I know, you know, a lot of my friends helped invent these things. I was around when they were conceived, and I have a lot of friends who are quants to this day working on high-frequency trading schemes. High-frequency trading is kind of an interesting moral quandary because, the trades happen so fast that there isn't time from the real world to enter them. So if you're saying there's some benefit to having a high-frequency trading scheme, it can only be within the world of the information system itself. It's not integrating information from the outside. There's just not enough time. But that could be valid. You could say, hey, my high-frequency trading scheme identified a little wobbling variable in the economy, and I'm correcting for it, so I'm making the whole thing a little more efficient. But that would only be true if there was a single monopoly high-frequency trading scheme. Since there are multiple ones, they resonate with each other, and they're correcting for each other's artifacts, and the whole thing just milks the society to no purpose. So it's one of the few industries that would actually make sense as a monopoly, but not otherwise. So then we could talk about the various kinds of hedged derivative funds, of which there are just legion. And I go through a variety of other financial schemes. There's some that don't really have names. The giant computers that organize logistical feats of multiplying money by having it earn interest in multiple places at once, by moving it very quickly around local rules, all these crazy things. If you don't know about that, that's a really big deal. That's a gigantic thing. And then the Silicon Valley, the familiar, the Facebooks and the Googles and everything. And then the national intelligence agencies, modern elections are run very much in this way. Criminal organizations are run this way. And then there's some that I really like and are utterly innocent and sweet intentioned. You know, Craigslist is a great example. Craig could have turned this thing into an eBay-sized or an Amazon-sized monster, and he wanted to do something modest and with great intentions, but it still defunds the newspaper. It still makes people's value not exist, you know. And the Wikipedia is kind of like that, too. Started with the best of intentions, and yet it does gradually leech the future of well-being for scholars.
Now, you kind of mentioned having friends who are quants working on the things that you're mm-hmm. sort of diametrically opposed to. What is it like kind of maintaining those friendships?
It's not as weird as working on those things myself, which I do. I want to be clear about this. It's really hard to live in the Bay Area without getting this feeling that you're superior to the rest of the world or something. I mean, it's true. There's this thing about us because we benefit so much. Silicon Valley has just outperformed every place, especially if you look at the variety of people who do well here. And my feeling is I'm not some perfect soul who knows better. I'm still functioning in the same world I'm criticizing. I'm not going to try to say I'm this absolutist who will not even participate in it. No, I'm working in Microsoft's labs, and I help out with Bing, which is trying to be one of these things, you know. And I'm not trying to reject this world. I'm just trying to talk about where it's going, and I want us to collectively come up with some way to steer it to a better destination. But I don't object to my friends. I mean, I think people should try to do well within the system. You know, I have friends at Google and I have quant friends. I don't reject those people. I just think we need to talk about what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, having witnessed kind of what Silicon Valley was during the first dot-com boom to where we are now, and I'm not going to call it a boom necessarily, but, you know, things are on the up and up. How does it differ, and how does the culture differ then to now based on what you're talking about in the book?
Well, it's changed a lot. I mean, the main thing that I liked about the PC era, leading up to the dot-com boom, let's say, is that when we sent people home with a PC, they would have their own data in their PC because it wasn't really networked yet. So people owned their own data, and therefore we created a lot more little businesses and whatnot. There were tons of little micro businesses that would do accounting or printing or all kinds of things because they owned their own data. And as soon as the network came in and we own the data, all of a sudden we're leeching away from all those people. So I don't feel as good about our customers, and I feel like the way we talk them into giving us their data is through flattery. Like, oh, you'll be on Facebook and you're so cool. I don't know. It's not a great... It's a little bit like the Lake Wobegon thing of everybody being above average. I mean, it's like sort of true for some people. But anyway, the point is that I don't feel as good about it. But the culture has shifted in the sense that at around the time that changed, there was this huge influx of the kinds of people who we always thought we were better than in a way. Because I remember in the old days, Silicon Valley was entirely populated by weirdos. You know, like all the companies were made of weird people and everybody was just an eccentric, strange, techie, genius person. And then all of a sudden there were these people who came in who were sort of handsome and well-dressed and were popular in school and all this stuff. And that's a different thing. I mean, that like the profile of a startup person doing some sort of social network or something now is that they look kind of good and they kind of make sense. And you look at them like, who are these people? You know, and
who are these people?
Yeah,
who are they?
Well, they're a new elite, and when you get to know them, they're really sweet. And, you know, I think the problem here is not a mistake of intent or sort of evil. I think it's just a good idea that turned out not to empirically work out. That's all. You know, I think the vast majority of people involved in these schemes are actually well-intentioned. That's one of the reasons why I think it's really worth talking about this stuff.
Mm-hmm. So I have a stack of questions here from the audience.
Okay.
And I'm going to pull this one out first because it's pretty good, and it's based on something specific you said, which mm-hmm. is that let's say self-driving cars do cause job loss. Won't new jobs be created? Like, you know, mechanics for self-driving cars or robot mechanics?
jobs are only created when we call the activity a job. So we have to remember that, let's go back to the 19th century for a second. The 19th century was absolutely drenched with anxiety that improving technology would make jobs go away. Most of the culture we remember from that century has something to do with the potential for human obsolescence, the Ballad of John Henry or the Luddites. Marxism was started out of that tension very explicitly. The early Marxist is this technology writer writing about that. And science fiction as a genre started that way. And the biggest science fiction themes are always about our machines making us obsolete, the Terminator and the Matrix and blah, 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 all that stuff. That's what it's always been about from its origins with H.G. Wells and why did the 20th century not disemploy everybody? And the reason why is that there was this thing called the labor movement. And what the labor movement said is, even if the new technology creates a role for people in which they're not as miserable and endangered as they used to be, they can still get paid for it. So like a great example for me is you go to Rochester, New York, before the rise of photography and this Kodak company we mentioned, which has gone bankrupt, before then was the buggy whip industry. And in moving from horse-drawn vehicles to motorized vehicles, there was actually this huge reduction in hassle, smell, and danger. Now, I adore horses. I know Palo Alto is a big place for horse culture, but I got to tell you, the poop is a problem. The hooves are a problem. They can kick you. I mean, you know, it's a whole thing dealing with horses.
Shelf life is kind of low.
Yeah. And some of them are just nasty, you know. And then you deal with cars, and with the exception of a few discredited imports or whatever, or a couple of they're just easier, and so and people pay to drive. We love driving, and so the question is, given that we love driving and it's so much easier, why would you even pay somebody to drive a truck or taxi? And there's exactly a reason for that, which is that as technology got better, there was this huge union movement to make sure that screenwriters and musicians and truck drivers and all these people had some sort of collective bargaining power, so that they could assert that even if they're not quite as miserable and their lives aren't quite as threatened as their forebears, what they're doing is still work and it's going to get paid. The only difference now is we've decided that, like, the translators who are aggregated to create a translation are no longer going to get paid, even though they're needed. So this idea that the difference between creating jobs and not creating jobs is a judgment about whether what people need to do should count or not. So people are still needed under the new regime, and it's up to us whether to count that or not. If we count it honestly, honest accounting leads to jobs. Dishonest accounting is called artificial intelligence.
I'm not even going to touch that.
I like teasing the people around Stanford.
Low-hanging fruit. I went to Berkeley, I can say that. What innovations are not fed by big data at this point?
There's a lot of kind of innovation that's really based on insight and is not based on big data. In fact, I'm a little concerned that we undervalue just thinking. You know, there's a tremendous tendency to believe that big data can solve all problems. Like, you run into people who are talking about the end of science as we know it, because big data correlations will replace the idea of theory and insight. And I don't believe that for a minute. I think that theory and insight are still essential, and I don't think we understand what understanding is. I don't think we understand what the brain does. I don't think we understand what meaning is. And I say that having worked on models of the brain and having looked at the question as a practitioner, not as a remote, you know, critic of the field. The main problem right now is that a lot of the frontiers of science and technology both are just very complicated. So compact insights are a little harder to come by than they might have been. I think there was a lot of low-hanging fruit, to use the term you just used, in the early 20th century in all the sciences and also in engineering, and we don't come across those quite as often these days.
Here's another one from the audience, and big data. Is it potentially more dangerous than collections of patents or IP?
Well, you know, the thing about... There's this kind of interesting, this calculus of oppositions that you get into when you try to talk about how the world should be different. So if I say the information should be free thing is problematic, then sometimes people will say, well, what about the patent system or all these ways? You know, there's a lot of ways for information to not be free that are also just ridiculously bad. And so I'm not arguing that the system we've had is perfect. In fact, I've just been saying that our mechanism of creating a middle class through ad hoc solutions like taxi medallions might be inferior to one that would arise more organically in a monetized network of information. So I'm all for improving on what we've had. And the patent system is ridiculous. I mean, there's so much stuff. The copyright system is lugubrious and crazy. The patent system makes us all nuts and creates this weird blockage on productivity for everybody in the system, whether they're big or small, and we're all miserable. And yeah, I mean, of course this stuff is stupid. We all know that. Except for my patent attorney friends who are doing very well in it, and I wish, you know, good for you. But of course, though, there's a lot of really stupid stuff in the way we're handling information now. There's no question about it. In the world I'm talking about, it should be a lot more fluid and easy to do things. Like if information is paid in a consistent way, then you should be able to reference somebody's work without having to go through a whole negotiation each time. It should become more standardized because they just set a price. It becomes like shopping instead of like negotiating. It should be much smoother and much more efficient.
Going back to jobs, I mean, is the answer to some degree just train more knowledge workers? I mean, should we all just be learning how to code and, you know, repair robots?
Okay, there's a two-part answer to that question. The first thing is, of course, we're not training enough technical people in our country right now, and we're not even letting the people we're training from other countries live here when they want to. So, of course, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. And everybody, like... I'm in a research lab, and everybody else who's in any kind of R&D organization is constantly dealing with this problem. There's a huge talent shortage at the upper reaches of technology. And by the way, you know, when I see my 6-year-old daughter learning basic math and stuff now, I just get enraged at what it seems to me like a poorly conceived curriculum for math and science, and I think it could be much, much, much better. So that's all true. And then, on the other hand, I do have to say that I don't want our culture to evolve to where only the technical, the sort of hackerly approach to things is validated. And I'm really concerned, for instance, like in the Wikipedia, we're creating this illusion that topics in the humanities have only one point of view because there's one master article. And that does work for a math entry or something, you know, like if there's a math proof, it's proved, you know, and there's this one thing and you can read about it. But that's not true for most topics of importance. And I'm a little concerned of over-technifying everything and losing cognitive diversity. I'm a little concerned that right now what we're doing is we're creating this society where everyone benefits by how close they get to one of the bigger computers. And so the more hacker-like you are, the better you do. And that leads to a loss of cognitive diversity among the people who are the most successful. And that can't be good.
Doesn't sound good. You know, here's another one. We were talking about this before, and I think it's an interesting one. Just, you know, what are the incentives for the world moving towards changing money for information?
Well, I think we'll start to see incentives when we see more and more meltdowns from too much power and wealth being concentrated around a big computer. So, you know, until we make it cost something to spy on people, we're going to keep on seeing this happening over and over and over again in every sector where there are big computers. And I think at some point, people are just going to get sick of it. I don't know how long it'll take. I think we have some time. I'm bringing this all up a little earlier than it might be brought up. I think we have 20 or 30 years, because I think that's when there's enough technologies of seeming automation that we really need to start to address this to have a functioning society. So we have a little bit of leeway. I don't know if we fix it at the last minute or if we try to do something more graceful. I'm sure we'll fix it either way. I hope we do something more graceful and that we're looking ahead.
So you mentioned this in your book, Who Owns the Future? And you mentioned this as well tonight. You know, you talk about a humanistic information economy, and your vision is maybe the answer is micropayments for everyone participating in the web. And what I'm curious about is the specific example you mentioned earlier tonight. You talked about cameras on the street, and if the camera picks you up, then you should be able to set your price for, mm-hmm. you know, what the data that has just been collected. So my question is, what would you set your price at?
Oh, me? I would play around with it. You know, I think in life, no, you experiment with different things. You know, in my life, I've experimented with buying the more expensive thing and the cheaper thing when I have options. And you find your own style. And I'd be empirical about it. And if I knew in advance, it wouldn't really be an economy, would it? So I plan to experiment when I get a chance.
Last question, how would I go about doing it? How would anyone in the audience pick their price?
Yeah, you know, I get multiple proposals, like many proposals every single day from people who think they have a magical bottom-up way of creating a transformation in society approximately like the things that I'm sort of vaguely invoking here. And I think this one can't be like this. I don't think this is like one of those what you can do. I think this one has to be a large conversation that eventually will have bottom-up components, but initially has to be maybe a bit top-down. I don't know. I mean, there's this tendency to want to get to, you know, this what you can do things like eat organic and eat local and all this stuff and bike to work. And I don't want to give false hope here that any particular thing like that is changing the world. I'd rather be a bit more cautious and not be a guru about that stuff. Let's talk about the ideas for a few years, and then maybe we'll start to get a clearer sense. I worry about people who present this sort of perfectly packaged solution for fixing the world, and I'm really not one of those people. I think I have a pretty good description of a problem, and I have at least a sketch of what a solution looks like, but I don't claim to have a whole roadmap. I think it's dangerous to overclaim about that sort of stuff, so I'm trying to be very careful about it.
Thanks so much. I think that's a perfect note to end on. I hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Jaron Lanier, author of Who Owns the Future, our audience here in Palo Alto, and all of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.